Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, if you don't like Mondays because you dread seeing your bully boss or backstabbing co-workers, and you live your days in fear of being fired, my first guest will share some great insights from the very latest in neuroscience to help you transform those situations. Coming up around 12:30, if you're one of those people who has idea after idea after idea, but never executes those ideas, you won't want to miss returning guest Stanford professor Tina Seelig. Her new book is called Insight Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World. And she teaches this stuff for a living at Stanford, has one of the most popular classes, and has some great ideas for you. As does my first guest, so let me introduce her. We are talking today with Joan Kingsley, and I just moved my paper. Where are we? Here we go. I want to make sure I give you the proper information here on her bio. She's a consultant clinical and organizational psychotherapist. She has a private practice in London, is honorary consultant psychotherapist at the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery, and is on the psychotherapist register of the School of Life. She works with senior management in business organizations and sits on the board of directors of two UK companies. She's also the vice president of New York-based organization. And she spent the past 25 years doing research into the links between brain systems and our psychological lives. And I know that she's written on fear, specifically fear in the workplace, for the past 20 years with one of her co-authors, Paul Brown. But let me bring on Joan Kingsley, first of all. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I want to just very briefly introduce your two co-authors to this book, and then we're going to dive right in here because there's some terrific information in here. And as we said, the latest neuroscience, the book is called The Fear-Free Organization, Vital Insights from Neuroscience to Transform Your Business Culture. And your co-authors, Dr. Paul Brown, faculty professor, organizational neuroscience at Monarch Business School for Switzerland, honorary chairman of the Vietnam Consulting Group, Saigon, and clinical and organizational psychologist and executive coach. Also, Dr. Sue Patterson, who's an oil and gas professional with over 30 years UK and international experience. She worked for Shell International and set up her own oil and gas consultancy in 2010, and in 2012 became the director of an international management consultancy. So a lot of great experience packed behind you, and together you put this book together. So let's start off with this, Joan, because I certainly have run into this myself, as I'm sure many of our listeners have. You say that fear is one of the most powerful motivating forces in today's working culture. First of all, that's very sad. It's also very ineffective. Yeah. You say that in many organizations, this is just a huge part of their culture, and it's so prevalent that you all took the time to put a book together. So talk to us a little bit about why it's so prevalent. What's going on today?
Well, first of all, fear is one of our eight basic emotions hardwired into our brain. So we've tended to think about emotions as being something other than us, not part of our physiology, when in fact all the research, neuroscientific research, now tells us that actually emotions are hardwired into our brains. They motivate us to act. They are put there by evolution to help us survive. Without emotions, we couldn't survive. Fear is the most primitive emotion. And it's the easiest one to trigger. So it's the easiest emotion for managers and leaders to tap into. Most people who become managers or leaders, they rise up through the hierarchy. do so because they're very good at doing their work. And often, although hopefully this isn't always the case, they really don't know much about people. And it's quite daunting to suddenly be put in charge of a team or a department and really not know what makes people tick. So the kind of easiest thing to do is to scare people, because then you get quick results. Unfortunately, they're very short-term results.
Right, and we see that every day in politics. We see it in the media. It, you know, people respond more instantly, I guess, to fear. And you do talk about in the book how, you know, it does stimulate that brain the brain there. So that's part of the reason it's so powerful as a tool. Unfortunately,
yeah.
Very unfortunately. So,
it's not very good business in the long term. So you get some good short-term results, but you wind up with a person working for you who is watching their back.
Right.
Because you go into, when you're afraid, you go into the fight, flight, freeze mode, and creativity kind of goes out the window.
Right.
And all you're doing is trying to survive, to keep your job, to make your boss happy, to say the right thing, to do the right thing. And the kind of honest, open, trust culture disappears for you.
Right. And it's that trust that is so important to not only our success, but to the company's success long term. Because I think we've all been in situations where people, you say in the book, you know, people spend, when they're in a fearful situation at work, they spend more time covering their back and trying to survive than they do on working productively. That's when you see a lot of gossip, bullying, undermining behaviors, hijacking tactics, you know, sabotage, people jockeying for favoritism, for position. It's not a fun place to be.
No.
And we might think that, you know, as an individual, well, what can I do within the company? But based on the latest neuroscience and some of the information you have in the book, there are things that we can do to change our immediate circle, correct?
Yes, that's right. I mean, the book really... rather than being a motivational book or a how-to book, it's really comes at it from a different perspective. When you use fear to manage somebody, to motivate somebody, you are tapping into areas in their brain that you really don't want to be going to. And so it's kind of educating people about what's happening when you make another person afraid. And, you know, this is also relevant in families. You know, we know that scaring people is not a very good idea.
Right.
It's kind of what you want to be doing is building relationships. And when you're working on fear, it kind of breaks the relationships down.
Well, you talk a lot through the book about how trust is the antidote to fear. And so we're going to take a quick break here so I don't have to interrupt you. And then when we come back, I'd like to look at how we start building that trust within ourselves and with coworkers, and so it all permeates outwards. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Joan Kingsley, and she's written a book full of really great information, actually. It's the Fear-Free Organization, Vital Insights from Neuroscience to Transform Your Business Culture. But, you know, as we just mentioned, as Joan just mentioned, this applies to families, too, to any kind of situation where you're dealing with people, really. So please stay tuned. We will be right back after this short break.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun. Coming August 10th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Does depression make you more susceptible to Parkinson's disease? A new study published in the journal Neurology says it does. So what's the link between depression and Parkinson's? And can you take steps to prevent or delay Parkinson's disease? Dr. Fiona Gupta, Medical Director of the Deep Brain Stimulation Program at Hackensack University Medical Center, joins Vicki to answer those questions and more. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific Time and find podcasts of shows at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Stay informed with news, traffic, and weather at the top of the hour, weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Like a fool. Take it easy on me. Take it easy on me.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and we're talking in this segment about eliminating fear in the workplace. I'm sure all of you out there listening right now have been in some situation, whether it was just with one person who kind of held the knife over your head sometimes, you know, or whether it was a culture that permeated throughout the entire organization. But this book is really based on the latest neuroscience. It is called The Fear-Free Organization, Vital Insights from Neuroscience to Transform Your Business Culture. And this is something you can take personally or globally throughout the company. And we're going to talk in this segment about building trust, because that's the antidote to fear. So we want to talk about trust and relationships. But I want to just touch on this, Joan, because you say in the book, you talk about building self-confidence by changing your thinking. You know, we're often told, change the way you think, you'll change your world. Tell yourself how wonderful you are. Tell yourself how powerful you are. Say your affirmations. And you say, okay, affirmations do have some instant feel-good results because they feed into the brain's reward system. But at the end of the day, you're going to still feel the same. And the real shift and your real sense of confidence is built on insight, and that means looking inward. So talk to us a little about that, if you would.
Well, there is. It is not possible to know another person unless you know yourself. You know, we all wake up in the morning, and sometimes we're having a good day, and sometimes we're not having a good day. And it's really important to check out with yourself, how am I today? What's going on for me? What am I taking to work? How might this impact the way I'm behaving at work? If I'm not feeling well, if I'm overtired, if I've got a hangover, what is the effect going to be on the people that I work with, on my colleagues, on the people who work for me? So that is powerfully important. And empathy is built on knowing oneself, because when you know oneself, then you can place yourself in the other person's shoes and understand how they're feeling.
Right.
And, you know, we go to work and we kind of want to get our work done, but you really do need to think about and be sensitive to the emotional state of the other people around you. And so often people don't want to talk about what's going on in their private lives and their personal lives, and I think that's absolutely fine. I don't think you need to open, you know, your veins in front of everybody. But I do think, particularly as a manager, you need to be quite sensitive. Who is this person? Do they seem to be off color? Am I off color? Am I having a bad day? is how I'm feeling affecting how I'm communicating? And then how are they feeling? And, you know, there's nothing wrong with saying to somebody who's working with you, I think maybe there's something going on. If you want to talk about it, fine. But, you know, I think it's affecting how the day is going for you. So that's the kind of honest, open communication. And it builds trust because it says, it's okay, I acknowledge that there's something going on. And it's the basis of trust, because when you know that somebody else knows how you're feeling, you build the trust, and then the relationship gets stronger. And relationship is everything at work. It's everything in all our lives. You know, we want to feel love. We want to feel excitement. We want to feel joy. And we can only do that in an environment where we feel safe, and safety is trust.
Right.
Yeah?
Yes, definitely. And it's a two-way street on communication, because you have to trust that what you're saying is being received the way that you intend it. So there's a lot of mindfulness around this, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you can put a name to it. Mindfulness is wonderful. You know, when you're mindful of yourself, you're mindful of others. And it's really, really important to be open and honest. If you're making a mistake, acknowledge what you're doing. And also, you touched on something very important, which is about how we perceive the world and the assumptions we make. So, for instance, if you say to me, I know what fear is. Well, I know what fear is for me, but I don't really know what it is for you. And there's never anything wrong with checking out. What do you mean by that? What is frightening for you? Because different people are afraid of different things.
Right. Right.
We tell a story in the book about two colleagues that have kind of grown up in the same community. And as children, they were at the same birthday party, and they're reminiscing about it. And her perception of the party is it was a great party. And his perception is, no, it wasn't. That clown was so scary because he was afraid of clowns. So you can be in the same place, have what you think is the same experience, and actually it's not the same experience. Yeah. And you can take that into the workplace and think about going to a meeting. And how you're perceiving the meeting is probably not the way another person in that meeting is perceiving it. So it's quite good to check out, well, I think this is how I, you know, this is what I assume was happening. Is that what was happening for you? So you can have these kind of mini dialogues that open up, build relationships, because, you know, when you understand something about another person, that's very powerful.
It's
and it also helps to build trust. And then, you know, you're moving right away from fear.
Yes.
And right into joy and excitement and love and happiness.
It's taking that, treat others as you'd like to be treated. It's taking that a step further into treat others, you know, how they want to be treated. Because, as you say, it's different strokes for different folks along almost every line, really.
Yes.
If we run into a situation where there's a broken trust, it can be even harder to rebuild that broken trust than it can be to build trust with somebody new in the workplace.
It's very, very difficult. Once somebody breaks your trust, there's something in you, in your fear system, that is tapped into, and you become wary of that person. And it can be very little things, like somebody, you know, in an organization who's grown up in a family where they were punished for doing, you know, making mistakes. And as an adult, when they make a mistake, they don't want to, you know, the pattern is, oh, I'm going to get punished. So they cover up.
Right.
So they might say, oh, that's so-and-so's fault, or I didn't do that. And those are very small ways of breaking trust with someone. Because then you start thinking, well, if they're not being quite open and honest about what they're saying here, what about all the other things they're saying? So, you know, once you break trust, it's difficult to reestablish a firm footing for relationships. And I'm sure we've all had friendships where we've had a close friend who has done something that's broken our trust. And, you know, you talk about it and you think you can get back on track. It's very difficult, and sometimes it's impossible.
Right. So what's going on with our neurobiology when we have that lack of trust? Or when we have trust, there's a great release of oxytocin, right? Or oxytocin.
Well, that oxytocin is about the it's the attachment, it's the bonding. You know, it's so you know, the neurochemistry is very, very complicated. There are many, many, many neurochemicals going on. There's so much going on in your brain all of the time. And it's a fine balance. And it's also very much about who you are and what kind of person you are, you know. So neurochemistry is just a little part of it. And I'm quite, you know, careful about throwing terms around because it's much more complicated than serotonin or adrenaline,
right?
Or, you know, because the chemical mix is incredible in the brain.
Yeah.
And not easy to understand.
So let's look at some, well, obviously it's not easy to understand. It's changing constantly, isn't it? This is what I think is so fascinating about neuroscience, that it's constantly changing. We're learning so much now. You talk about that in the book, how much, you know, you started writing about this 20 years ago, but now there's so much scientific data to support what you were talking about.
And as much as there is, there's so much more to come over the next 50 years.
Yes.
I mean, this is just the very beginning of knowledge.
So
let's
look at some practical tools here about, this happens a lot to many people. I have a friend who's going through it right now, and quite honestly, I think it's aged her 10 years, so I hope she gets out of this situation quickly. But when you have a boss who's just a bully, who just has nothing good to say about you or anybody in this particular case, and puts people down constantly, how do you begin to deal with that situation?
Well, I think, first of all, you've got to keep a record. You have to keep a diary of the encounters with that person. And, you know, when somebody starts bullying you, and it's not generally somebody, you know, you've known. Generally, it will be a new boss starts, or you get transferred into another department, or your boss leaves and somebody new comes in. So when you are confronted with a bully, it's really important to keep a record. And the problem with bullying, you know, you said your friend aged 10 years. Well, that's what happens. The self-confidence goes incredibly quickly. And you know, if you talk about trust, what happens when somebody's bullying you is you don't trust yourself.
Right.
You feel paranoid. You feel maybe you're imagining things. And so it's important to talk to your friends about what's going on, to talk to a professional, and then to keep a record. And when you go into meetings with a bully, you push the record button on your phone. So you record things. And when you have enough evidence, you go either to HR or to, you know, another manager in the organization, a sympathetic person, and present your case. You try and get transferred out, but the fact is you may have to leave. And that's very easy to say. You know, it's not so easy for somebody who has to pay their rent, and, you know, their livelihood depends on this bully. And it's very frightening to think about having to move on and move out. I mean, particularly in difficult economic times when you want to hold on to your job.
Right.
So I think the most important thing is the record keeping mm-hmm. and the evidence and building up the evidence.
Right. And I think in some cases, maybe not in many cases, but in some cases, that person who's doing the bullying may not even realize how they're coming across. And so...
Yes, that's true. And not everybody who yells is a bully either.
Right.
I mean, I know a lawyer who yells at everybody. And, you know, if you go into his office, everybody loves him because they know that it's all bluff and bluster. So bullying comes in many forms, some of it loud and noisy, some of it subtle. Generally, people who are bullying somebody, they kind of know what they're doing.
So,
you know,
yes.
it's often a way of getting rid of somebody.
Right, right. It's shutting
know,
that interaction.
Don't want to fire people, so they use other methods.
Other tactics, yeah. So a couple of quick practical tips, because we're almost at the end of our segment here, on how we can make sure that our bosses trust us to deliver the best we can.
Sorry, I didn't quite hear what you said.
Yeah, can you share a couple of practical tips on how we can make sure that our bosses trust us to deliver the best we can? Because nobody likes being micromanaged.
Well, I think being honest, being open, and being trustworthy yourself, and also, you know, delivering on time, not making promises you can't keep, not trying to undermine other people, being a really good, upstanding citizen at work, I think goes a long way.
Yep, it does. And the book is called The Fear-Free Organization, Vital Insights from Neuroscience to Transform Your Business Culture. It's written by Paul Brown, Joan Kingsley, Sue Patterson, and of course my guest today, Joan Kingsley, consultant clinical and organizational psychotherapist. Thank you so much for being with us, Joan. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I think it's really important when you are, particularly for young people, you're going out into the world of work, do your research, find out what the culture of the organization is like before you take a job. And you can hang out at Starbucks near the organization. You can talk to friends who might know people who work there. I think that's a really important thing to do. Know where you're going to work and know what the culture is like and make sure it fits you
yes.
and what you want.
Yes, I think that's great advice. Well, Joan Kingsley, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
And the book is called The Fear-Free Organization, Vital Insights from Neuroscience to Transform Your Business Culture. And Joan joined us from London there, so thanks for cutting into your evening there. Please do stay with us. We will be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun. Let's see if I guess that... this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing. Writing it, another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Peggy Kaler at West Star Pacific Mortgage in Duval, we cover the world of animals. This week, August 2nd, it's Shelter, Rescue, Sanctuary, and Anything That Helps Our Animal Friends Sunday, and it's Seafair Sunday. That means a short version of Animal World before the hydro races begin at 10 a.m. will feature Macaw Rescue and Sanctuary's annual open house, barbecue, and auction on August 8th. So join us for Martha Norwalk's Animal World Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
News, traffic, and weather? Now you can get your information fixed weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And today there's certainly an insatiable demand for innovation and entrepreneurship. And my next guest has written a super book. It's called Insight Out. Get ideas out of your head and into the world. And it's packed full of new research and stories and examples that are from around the world, from Silicon Valley to St. Quentin State Prison, Pakistan and the North Pole. And it's full of strategies that will help bring even the slightest flicker of an idea in your head to life. So let me just introduce my guest. She is Tina Seelig. She has a PhD in neuroscience from Stanford University Medical School. She's a professor of the practice in the Department of Management Science and Engineering at Stanford School of Engineering and executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. She's also the best-selling author of What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20 and Ingenious, a Crash Course on Creativity. And we talked to Tina about that a couple of years ago, I believe it was. In 2009, she was awarded the prestigious Gordon Prize from the National Academy of Engineering for pioneering work in engineering education. And in 2014, she was honored with SV Forum Visionary Award. And it's a special day for Tina today. It's her birthday, and she's still joining us today. So, Tina Seelig.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, welcome, and happy birthday. Thank you for joining us on your birthday today.
Thank you.
So where to begin on this book? I often ask guests this question. What do you wish you had known 20 years ago? And you wrote a book on that, which became a bestseller. And you actually, you said that when you were looking at this book, you realize that this new book, Insight Out, is exactly what you'd wish you'd known when you were 20. And I'm going to read just a little paragraph here from your book, What I Wish I'd Known When I Was 20. You say, I'm going to be 20 this next month, and I'm supposed to be a real person by now, an adult, responsible, having a purpose. I feel so far from that now. I want to be interesting, and I don't find myself interesting. I want to be intelligent, and I'm not. I want to be the type of person I would like to meet, and it seems so fruitless. Perhaps the goals I have for myself are ridiculously high and I should stop before I start. Well, thank goodness you didn't.
Yeah, that's a remarkable story behind that quote. It was 1 week after my book, What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, 1 week after it came out, and I stumbled upon a letter I had written to myself on the eve of my 20th birthday. And when that came out, I was just turned 50. So it was 30 years earlier, I had written this letter. I had no memory of it. And it was shocking to me about how far I had come from someone who really had such high aspirations, and yet I felt so lost and really unclear about how to reach them, to someone who's now an adult, and of course today's my birthday again, and being able to have gotten to a place in my life where I can say, wow, here are the things that helped me really reach my goals.
Well, you say 30 years later you believe there are three crucial elements needed to build a bridge to the future you want: an entrepreneurial mindset, specific tool set, and a clear roadmap. So let's talk a little about those three.
Right. So essentially, the three things are an attitude, sort of your mindset. The second is a set of tools. And then the third is how you actually weave them together. How you essentially marry your attitudes and your actions to actually make things happen. And you, of course, need a vision of where you're trying to go.
Right.
And it's been fascinating for me. I've been teaching classes on creativity and innovation and entrepreneurship at Stanford for the last 16 years. And for me to see so many students come by, each year another crop of students who have the same aspirations and the same anxieties, and to see how you really can teach them to get ideas out of their head and into the world.
Yes. You say, actually, it's a crime not to teach people to be entrepreneurial. You say that in the book. Explain that to us.
Yes, I really do. I think we are responsible for preparing young people, as well as older people, but we're certainly responsible for preparing young people to be able to lead the lives they want to live, to come up with big dreams for themselves, and then how to achieve them. And yet we don't do that effectively. In fact, we don't even do it explicitly. We look at our schools as a way to sort of pour a bunch of knowledge into their heads. But then they get out at the end, and they don't actually know even what their passions are or how to find their passions, and certainly not how to act upon them. And I think it really is our responsibility to give people the opportunities to experiment with that as they're growing up and to hone the skills and the mindset to allow them to really live their dreams.
Yeah, because if you look at how much culture has changed over the last 20 years with the advance of technology, and has schooling kept up with that? Not really, has it?
Yeah, I totally agree. And the thing that's most important to keep in mind is the world is changing so fast. The specific skills and knowledge you're going to gain when you're in school are going to be completely different. I mean, of course, there are basic understandings of, you know, the elements and history, and basic things you learn in school, but the specific context is going to keep changing. And so we really need to educate people who are very flexible, who are persistent, but also resilient, folks who can see opportunities and see the problems around them as really opportunities in their midst. In fact, at our office at Stanford, we have a big sign on the wall. We have two of them, a big sign painted on the wall. One says, "Every problem is an opportunity." The bigger the problem, the bigger the opportunity. So that sort of mindset is the idea of looking at the world as a place that's opportunity rich.
Right.
And the other sign says, entrepreneurs do much more than imaginable with much less than seems possible.
Yes.
And it's that entrepreneurial mindset is about taking limited resources and leveraging them to make really big things happen.
And I think this is important to say, because your message is that entrepreneurship isn't just about starting companies. It's about anything from, you say, forming a rock band to planning a trip around the world. And this book presents a framework for bringing those ideas to life, whatever those ideas may be.
Exactly. And what I do is I lay out a roadmap that takes you from imagination to creativity to innovation to entrepreneurship. And I show what are the attitudes and actions that have to take place at each step to move you through this process. And I really start out with a problem that I found in my own teaching, was that there really wasn't a clear vocabulary around the term imagination, creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship. And therefore, people would use these terms interchangeably, but not just that, they use them in a sloppy way such that it became sort of clear to almost everyone, well, you can't teach this, because they were all thinking about different things.
Yes.
So I put a stake in the ground about, you know, what these definitions are and how they're related to each other.
Yeah, I think that's great, because, you know, certainly in the world that I run in, the word innovation is thrown out there, you know, 500 times a day. And I think for many, it doesn't really mean anything anymore.
Well, that's the point. Exactly. If you're using a term and it doesn't really mean anything, it's just a throwaway. But if you can actually define it clearly, I mean, you think about it, when we teach physics or math or science or even music, you know, we have a very clearly defined set of words and relationships, and this is allows us to not just communicate effectively, but then to apply them. And so that's what I'm trying to do.
Yes. And so I think we'll take a break first, because I don't want to interrupt in the middle of this, because I want to take a look at this breakthrough model that you've put together. You call it the invention cycle, and it consists of those four stages you just mentioned. But I'd like to look at it in more detail and what that means and how it helps us get our ideas out into the world.
Great. Thank you.
So please do stay with us. We will be right back. My guest is Tina Seelig. Her book is called Inside Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Pause has the dog or cat of your dreams just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at pause.org or call 425-787-2500.
Coming August 10th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Does depression make you more susceptible to Parkinson's disease? A new study published in the journal Neurology says it does. So what's the link between depression and Parkinson's? And can you take steps to prevent or delay Parkinson's disease? Dr. Fiona Gupta, Medical Director of the Deep Brain Stimulation Program at Hackensack University Medical Center, joins Vicki to answer those questions and more. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific Time and find podcasts of shows at conversationslive.net.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Lewis and Clark would be proud. We're exploring new territory on the air every day right here on Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Tina Seelig. She is a professor at Stanford University and executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. She's also a best-selling author. And today we're talking about her new book, Inside Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World. And I think this is such a great book. And as we shared in the first part of the segment, it's not just about starting companies, it's about getting any idea off the ground. So Tina, I wanted to look in this segment about I wanted to look at what you call the invention cycle, which you say was a huge missing piece. So can you run with that for us, please?
Right. As I mentioned earlier, I realized that there was a really big missing piece in terms of the clear vocabulary around the process of going from inspiration to implementation. And so I spent quite a long time, I mean at least a year, collecting my thoughts and my insights around this and came up with a framework which I call the invention cycle. And here's how it goes. It's pretty straightforward, and the goal of it is to be something that's easily remembered. So imagination is envisioning things that don't yet exist. And we all do this. We do it all day long. I mean, we're born with our ability to envision things in our head. Creativity is applying your imagination to address a problem or a challenge in your life. Again, this is something that is very natural every day. You know, we wouldn't be able to survive if we weren't creatively adapting to our environment. Innovation is applying our creativity to come up with a unique solution. So this is what most people talk about when they talk about ideas. They want to come up with things that no one has done before. So an idea, like if I invent a peanut butter sandwich, I'm creative because it might be new to me, but I'm not innovative because it's not new to the world. So something that's innovative is new not just to me, but also to the entire community that I'm in. Entrepreneurship is applying the innovation to scale it and bring it to everyone else. And so what happens is once you have this hierarchy of going from imagination to creativity, innovation to entrepreneurship, you can now break it down and you can look at the attitudes and the actions that have to happen in each step. So would you like me to just list what has to happen?
Yes, that would be awesome.
Okay, great. So in the imagination stage, you need to be engaged with the world and envision what might be different. That's all it is. That's what imagination is, engaged and then envisioning what might be different. Creativity requires you to be motivated, like motivated to address a problem, and then willingness to experiment. So it's a motivation and experimentation. Innovation requires incredible focus and then reframing. And that reframing means looking at things from a unique, new perspective. And then entrepreneurship requires persistence because it's a tremendous amount of work to scale your ideas and also inspiring others. And that's a real key. That's why it turns into a cycle, because you are now inspiring other people's imagination, where they're now going to trigger their invention cycle and start moving from imagination to creativity to innovation and entrepreneurship.
Right. I love that you share so many stories, so many stories in the book, Tina, both, business stories from across the world, and you also share some personal stories. And on the imagination section, there's a chapter called Envision, and you share a story. You say, I know what it's like to be both driven and limited by my own vision, because I think that's where many of us get stuck. We get limited. We put a ceiling over ourselves before we even start. And you share a story there of how you decided to promote a book you wrote called The Epicurean Laboratory. I wonder if you'd share that with us.
Yeah, this is a really interesting point, is that people often don't clearly define the stage on which they want to play out their life. Because if you think about it, it's the same skills to be the president of the United States as the president of the school PTA, right?
Right.
If you're leading an organization, it's the same skills. So what stage do you want to be on? Do you want to be on your local stage? Do you want to be on your community stage? Do you want to be on a national stage? Do you want to be on a global stage? So what happened is I had started a company. It was after my first book came out many years ago, 1991. And I started a company that was a precursor to Amazon. It was called Book Browser. And it was, as you imagine, it was before the web. And it was a kiosk-based system for bookstores. But I had never started a company before, and therefore I was somewhat limited by even my goals. My goal was to prove that I could start a company and sell it in 2 years, because there were a lot of resistance to my even starting. And so when I hit hurdles along the way, I wasn't able to get around them. I now know that there were certainly ways for me to get around those hurdles. But what happened is when I hit a lot of the hurdles after 2 years, I sold the company, because that was consistent with my vision for myself. My vision was, I want to build the company and sell it in 2 years. And guess what? That's what I did. Had I had a vision of running a global firm, then when I hit these hurdles, I would have been able to say, you know what? I'm going to do whatever I need to do to get around these hurdles. And so we really need to think in advance about what our ultimate goals are, because if our goals are too small, we're going to basically limit ourselves.
Yes. I fascinating this, because I didn't know this. I've read a lot on Richard Branson, but more about his successes than failures. And I didn't realize how many failures Virgin had had. And there's a lot of failures on the list in your book here. So, it is about having that big idea and getting out there and trying it. He certainly didn't let that fear of failure
exactly.
stop.
Exactly. Well, it's interesting. In my book, What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, I actually describe the fact that I have my students write failure resumes, all their biggest screw-ups, personal, professional, and academic. And, in fact, I include my own failure resume in the book. And the idea is that if you're not failing, sometimes you're not taking enough risks, and that the key thing, though, is you need to mine those failures for insight. Is that failures, as when we're kids, right, we're learning how to walk and talk and ride a bicycle and, get up and give a speech. And we have lots and lots of errors along the way. Nobody expects a young kid to do something perfectly the first time. Why do we expect adults who are doing complicated things the first time not to have some errors or surprises? So we need to embrace that as part of the learning process.
There's you talk in the book about if people challenge your ideas, that is not a bad thing when you're in that first phase here. You know, when they say, oh, that's never going to work, that's not a bad thing. Why?
Oh, yeah. I tell my students this all the time. Having resistance to your ideas is a gift. Now, I can hear the listeners sort of going, yeah, right. But you know what? It's actually true because it allows you to test strength of your own convictions. If people are always telling you, great idea, then you never know, were you doing it because you really wanted to, it was really resonated with you, or something that everyone else wanted. I see that oftentimes with, you know, kids who, you know, have worked so hard to get into college, and then they get there, and they're lost about what they're doing there. You know, nobody ever criticized you for applying to Stanford or Harvard or Princeton or any other school. And so you often don't know what your own goals are. In fact, for my own life, I often had to do things the first time for other people, and then I quit. And then the next time I did it, it was for myself.
Yes.
I started graduate school, and I left graduate school. My parents were distraught. I moved out to California, lived in Santa Cruz. I was this hippie chip, you know. And then I ended up going back to graduate school, but it was on my own terms. It was my own choice. And I felt like it really would resonate with me. I wasn't doing it just because other people wanted me to do it.
Right. We've only got a couple of minutes here, Tina. I wish we could talk much longer, but I want to get this in because I think it's such a good point. In the book, you say that you often run into individuals desperately looking deep inside themselves to find something that will drive their passion. They miss the fact, you say, that for most of us, it's action that leads to our passion. Passions are not innate. They grow from our experiences. And you do share a great story there of an opportunity. You say many times in your life that you've looked for a new direction. One of those times turned out to be life-changing for you, but it's an opportunity you almost missed when you crumpled up the piece of paper and threw it in the trash. So share that with us if you would.
Exactly. But this is true for everything. And this is a very, very profound point, that your passions are not innate. They grow from your experiences. So people often think, oh, I'm going to go sit quietly and figure out what I'm passionate about. But your passions follow your actions. So if you, and one of the examples I give in the book is, like, if you're a waiter at a restaurant, you know, you could, you know, be just doing it like rote and just every day leaving and thinking, wow, I finished that day. Or you can say, well, let me pay attention. What days do I get higher tips than others? What days do different people order different things off the menu? Let me look at the demographics of who's here. You know, there are also the things. Let's say you're looking at tips. Every day you can do experiments to see what you do to get a higher or lower tip. You could become an expert on customer service. That could be parlayed into an entire career about customer service and hospitality. And yet it could start from just being a waiter at a restaurant. So by paying attention, you start seeing opportunities that other people miss.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, great advice in this book. There's some great stories in here that give really rock-solid examples of what Tina's talking about in her model. And it's called Inside Out. The book is called Inside Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World by Stanford professor Tina Seelig. And I thank you so much for being with us, Tina. I really appreciate
it. My pleasure. Great day way to spend my birthday.
Yes, and a very happy birthday to you. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you so much. Take care.
And I want to thank each of you for joining us today, of course, too. And if you have any questions or feedback or comments on today's show, you can reach me at info@conversationslive.net or at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. You can also find us on Facebook, and you can find Tina Seelig on Facebook, too. And on Twitter, as you can also find Tina Seelig on Twitter. You'll find me at Vicky St. Clair. And on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. So we'll be back next week with a live new show. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you.
call 425-269-4772.
Coming August 10th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Does depression make you more susceptible to Parkinson's disease? A new study published in the journal Neurology says it does. So what's the link between depression and Parkinson's? And can you take steps to prevent or delay Parkinson's disease? Dr. Fiona Gupta, Medical Director of the Deep Brain Stimulation Program at Hackensack University Medical Center, joins Vicki to answer those questions and more. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific time and find podcasts of shows at Conversations.live.net.